Before we begin, I would like to promote our new Patreon, patreon.com/bitterbrownfems, where you can go and support this podcast by donating anywhere between $1 and $15 a month in exchange for a reward. There is no too little a donation. We appreciate every bit we get. And check out more info at patreon.com/bitterbrownfems. Now let's start the show.
We'll do it live. Okay. We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. Fucking thing sucks.
5, 4, 3. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Bitter Brown Femmes. This is Cassandra. You might know me online as @Chicanisma.
And this is Ruben, and you might know me as Queer Chicano Chisme.
So, our last episode was kind of really, like, we just dragged the shit out of everybody, I feel, which was cool. Hope you all enjoyed that episode and learned something. Thank you for coming back after the drag.
That was all you. I very much don't believe in call-outs. Wow. You know, like, I'm super about, like, you know, just, like, educating everyone, like, super privately and, like, super patient, right? Because I have all the time in the world. Yeah. No, I'm super respectable. So what have you been up to in your respectable life?
In my respectable life, I have been, driving to school carefully, the speed limit, not getting pulled over, and, voting.
Oh, yeah! Every season, and you voted for my homeboy, the Kennedy, what's his name? Beto.
Oh, God.
Betito O'Rourke.
Robert.
Betito
Robert.
Del Rancho O'Rourke.
Robert O'Rourke. I did not vote for him.
Wow.
Let's not talk about him. We'll talk about him at another time. I don't really...
You don't want to beat Ted Cruz? Okay.
Wow.
I get it. You're here for your Latino people, right? Like,
La Raza, I gotta support together. Rafael Cruz.
Yeah, it's
because
Rafa.
we are both Latinx, so I just have to, you know.
Yeah, representación. Him. Yeah. No.
That's what representation looks like for me in Texas.
Where the fuck? Anyway, I want to know where he came up with Ted. But that's another conversation, I guess.
Yeah, that is really, like, how did you go from Rafael to Ted? That's what I want to know. But also, anyway, as I mentioned, it is Aries season. And so I've been really, like, trying not to go off on people. Because, you know, Aries just want to fight everybody. So if you want to fight someone, I feel like this is, like, the moment to do it.
Yeah, one of my best friends is actually an Aries. And they, like, used to, like, want to call me out for everything. And I'm like, you're being very elitist right now.
Aries want to fight. Like, they think everyone's fighting them. You're like, hey. And they're like, what'd you say to me?
Yeah.
I'm like, wow. Okay, relax.
Yeah.
But you know what? Some of our favorite people are Aries, like Mariah Carey.
Mariah Carey, yes.
And Gerard Way.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, they're both Aries.
There's something here happening that, like, we didn't... What is it? What's happening? Why do we connect with them? That's our Aquarius connecting with them?
No. Well, me as a fire sign, Aries is the second best fire sign. Mm. Sagittarius is number one. Leos don't even count. But I love Aries. I love Aries femmes.
Yeah.
Like, men, you know, like, all men, I don't really know about them. But Aries femmes, I fuck with. Even though they're a little extra, but I feel like I relate to that on some kind of level.
Yeah.
Some people, like, Aries are too much for people. For water signs, I feel like water signs will cry.
Yeah.
Maybe not Scorpios, but Pisces and Cancers. But anyway, I just really like them, yeah, because they're rude, and I'm rude too.
I'm also realizing
Mars
that.
Is in Aries.
Yeah.
I relate to that.
I don't know where my Mars is. You know where that is. It's in Taurus.
I think it's in Aquarius, so you just run away from confrontation.
What? I am so confrontational. Wow.
I have receipts that you're not, but
we'll
talk about that at another time.
Wow, fuck you then. No, I realize now that, like, another one of my friends is, like, actually multiple of my friends are Aries. I just, like, never cared.
Connected it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because also, like, these were friends that I made when I was, like, hella drunk in my early 20s. So, so yeah, no. So, and I usually like fire signs. Like, people don't like Leos, but I fucking love Leos. Like, they're my bitches. And they like me, too, because I hype them up. And they're like, wow, Ruben's so brilliant. And I'm like, yeah. But also, I'm a Leo rising, so, like, this all makes sense.
Leos, I just, bye. I don't have time to fucking hype you up.
Mm, okay, bitch.
No, because they're just, I do not like them. I don't like Leos. sorry, there's probably like one or two Leos out there. Not all Leos, you know, hashtag. But the majority of you just buy. Like, what do? Nothing. So, anyway, let's talk about what is going on, though, aside from our lives.
I mean, what has been going on this week? What else really matters?
Something that
matters. It's called Bitter Brown Femmes, not Bitter Brown the Issues of the World, right?
Right, of course. We have to come back. I wish we could just talk about nothing. I wonder if people would listen to us.
I think a lot of people do think we talk about nothing, right? They're like,
that is true.
I mean, was that one bitch who was like, I just read them for the keys or whatever?
Oh, yeah. So, like, Ruben makes fun of me because I was like,
because you always searching, search your name, weirdo.
I always search my name. I search at Chicanisma to see what people are saying about me. And it's mostly because I'm like, wow, if there's a valid critique, like, I'm down for that, right? But they're usually all just like, this, like, you know, they're just like mad, mostly about like the white Latinx stuff. And so they like talk shit about me, which is like, whatever, it's fine. But anyway, I was searching Bitter Brown Femmes, or I don't know what I was searching, but I came across this tweet that like I shared on Twitter with someone was like, the two worst Chicanisma and Queer Chicano Chisme are the worst social media platforms on the internet, but I follow them sometimes, every now and then for the keys. And I'm like, okay. I think keys means for the kicks, no? I sound old.
Yeah. Like, for, like, laughs. Like, for, like, shits and giggles.
Oh, for shits and giggles, yeah.
Yeah.
So they're probably listening right now.
Yeah, hi, so, person.
Hi. Hi. Hello, communist. Or Marxist. They're a Marxist.
No, it's a black flag and a red umbrella and, like, a red rose and something else.
Yeah. But on their actual thing, it said they were a Marxist communist.
Oh, see, them bitches don't like me. The Marxist-Leninists, like, we don't roll. Like, I remember, like, having some conversations and just being like, oh, yeah, like, as an anarchist, blah, 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 and they just, like, block me. And I'm just like, whatever, bitch. Like we can talk. We can exchange ideas, but they don't want to, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And
why can't we just listen to each other?
Right.
And exchange ideas for the better good.
For the liberación. Yeah. But you know who we don't talk to about ideas? And who? Liberación? La policía.
No, we do not. We do not fuck with them. You know who else doesn't fuck with them?
Hasta Muerte Coffee up in Oakland, bitches.
Yes. So everyone, if you're in Oakland or in the area, you should go to Hasta Muerte. Hasta Muerte. Hasta Muerte.
Bocha.
Fuzz, my bocha coming out. Hasta Muerte Coffee in Oakland, and support them because they took a stand. So on not serving police officers in uniform. And so they wrote about that on their Instagram that it was actually like a Latino who went in uniform. And they were like, nah, like, get the fuck out of here. Well, you know, maybe not like that. But they were like, our community doesn't feel safe in the presence of police officers, which is a very fucking valid thing, especially if you're queer, undocumented, if you're a woman, if you're black, right? And so this cop went and told all his other cop friends, and then it became this thing, and they wrote a story about it, like, on the news. And so they've received a lot of backlash from racists and conservatives and Nazis. And so, yeah, you should go support them. And also, because last week there was actually like white supremacists that showed up to protest in front of their coffee shop because of their stance, saying that it was anti-American.
Yeah. And like, what's so wrong with being anti-American, right? If it's like something that's built on, it's of a fucking police state, right? And so, in case you're not familiar with Oakland, like, this is also like a primarily like black and like Latinx like area, right? They are literally like looking out for like the citizens of the town, like, right? Because who feels safer on police? And it's people who are moneyed, people who are white, right? Because at the end of the day, right, police are here not only to protect, property, right, but to also to protect white bodies, right, and from what and from whom, right? Like, the big bad, like, black people and immigrants and, like, other bodies that are deemed violent, right?
Yeah, and also in recent news was the Austin bomber, who the first people that he targeted in Austin were communities of color. Right. And so Communities of color are under attack in a lot of different ways, not just like via gentrification, but also from actual violence from white people. Like this 24-year-old who was just, you know, bombing people of color and targeting people because I don't know what was the headline that he was sad. or he did it, or
so stupid.
Whatever the fuck, right? And so when our
when
our communities defend themselves, it's like we receive backlash when they're the, like these people that are attacking, like they're the reason that we have to defend ourselves in that way to begin with. But going back to the Austin bomber, so the whole narrative has been that it's like this lone white boy and no one knows why he did it, but that's like the narrative we see every single fucking time, and so it's not new.
Now they're just doing it to troll us, which I haven't really like talked about on any of the platforms, because it's just like nothing is reporting on it in any way that doesn't play into like this fury that they're trying to incite from people of color, right? Everything's like, oh, look at this sad white boy. And it's just like, no, like, we all know by now that it's white terrorism, but we don't call it that because that doesn't sell newspaper, right? That doesn't, or doesn't get clicks, right? And so, yeah, it's really infuriating how black and people of color, indigenous people, are seen as violent, right? Even when we're just existing, right? Like Stephon Clark was recently shot in Sacramento by Sacramento Police Department, right? In his own backyard, right? In his family's backyard, for holding a cell phone, right? And the Sacramento Black Lives Matter chapter has like been, you know, holding it down, right? And organizing, but they're not getting like the kind of coverage and the kind of support that other movements recently have been getting, right? And it's because of who the U.S. sees as worth protecting, right? And whose anger is validated and whose lives, you know, ultimately matter.
Yeah. As we mentioned on our last episode, in regards to the Black Lives Matter movement and Black activists in general, and in specifically right now with the Parkland High School students and how they're getting a lot of positive coverage, whereas, again, Black Lives Matter activists hardly get any, and if they do, it's in a negative light. Like, they're shutting down traffic. Oh, no. Right? Like, there must be other respectable ways to do this, but any way that they do it is not acceptable either way. And today is actually the March for Our Lives, speaking of.
Yeah.
I'm not there, obviously, because I'm here. But that is not because I don't support that cause. I think it's been very powerful to see like all of these young kids like go out there and with like signs and like speaking. There have been, especially black children, especially brown children, like that has been very empowering, because like it's mostly been like these five white Parkland students that I see like time and time again. But I know that there's like teens in Chicago who are speaking out about the gun violence in Chicago. So it's not just about school shootings, it's also about gun violence in every form, right? And that also has to do with like state violence, which is like with police officers, with ICE officers, with Border Patrol, with domestic abuse, with, so just, it's not just about school shootings, even though that is the root of it.
Yeah, and I like that these kids, like we've mentioned before, are bringing up all these other like intersecting issues, right? Even though ultimately that's not what the media pays attention to. Right? And so, some Feminista Jones recently wrote a thread about how she was really angry that, you know, there's like kids in Chicago, like you mentioned, who have been organizing for ages, right? Because people always talk, when people want to derail conversations about like police brutality against black bodies, they're always like, what about Chicago? Mm-hmm. Right? And it's just like, what about Chicago? Like, black kids and, like, you know, and black organizers in general have been, like, rallying against gun violence, right? Not only, like, intra-community gun violence, but also, like, police and state violence, right? For, you know, time, you know, eternal at this point. But because the people and the lives in question, right, are not deemed, you know, worthy of protection, right? There's never been this type of coverage before. But now because we have, you know, these white kids from this Republican state, right? Or like swing state, Florida, right? All eyes on them. You know, they get the cover of Time magazine. And that reminds me that like, yes, these kids, these white kids are like getting the spotlight, right? But they're also like passing the mic in ways that I think, admittedly, like my fucking 15-year-old ass wouldn't have like the range to do, right? And so today we saw like some powerful speeches, right, from I think the one that I saw and that I connected to was, you know, Edna from South LA, right? I'm from Southeast LA. She talks about how, like, she learned how to duck, right, when she heard gunshots before she learned how to read, right? And talking about how, like, gun violence has affected her family, right? And so, to me, that's, like, a narrative that showed how much trauma these kids are, like, dealing with, right? And not only, you know, the community violence and the state violence, but now the violence of being, you know, criticized and put on this national platform where all eyes are on them and all these adults are, like, you know, bashing them, right? And so I'm, like, looking at her and I'm just like, yeah, like, I experienced that too, right? Like, I'm also from Southeast LA, right? Like, all this shit resonated. I don't think at that age I would have been able to go in front of thousands of people and just, like, spoke my truth, right?
Yeah, it's when I see the videos and, like, the photos of children, I'm like, wow, they're so powerful. And, like, I saw this video that I, of this little girl named Naomi Wadler that I shared. She's 11 years old, and she's a little black girl, and so she pretty much just spoke on, she said in her speech, "I am here today to represent and acknowledge the African-American girls whose stories don't make the front page of every national newspaper." And her whole speech was devoted to black women and black girls who have been killed by gun violence, right? And so I literally was, like, crying because, you know, I mean, what's fuck? But it was very powerful. And at the same time, though, I'm like, it's so fucked up that they have... Why does an 11-year-old need to stand in front of thousands of fucking adults and say, please, like, do something about this, right? Like, please make... Have some fucking... respect for us as children, right? Because this is a conversation I always have with everybody about children.
You've definitely called me in on it. Yeah. And I feel like when we have conversations about, like, ageism, I think you always make a point to talk about, like, ageism against, you know, teenagers and kids, right?
Yes. And it's a lot to unpack. I feel that maybe we should have a deeper conversation about it at another time. But I do want to say that the ways in which we marginalize children and we don't see them as a marginalized group is also why any kind of abuse towards children, it starts with the way that we see children. And I think that's being highlighted right now because I see all the fucking comments from adults bashing children. And I, like, first I'm like, regardless if you're fucking, like, pro-guns asshole, like, you're literally bashing a fucking 11-year-old right now, right? And saying, like, they shouldn't be allowed to speak on this. But I'm like, but they're allowed to be killed by, like, guns, but they can't speak out about that, right? And so, like, I think the very minimum is respecting children and their agency and not assuming that some adult put them on there and that they can't have thoughts of their own, right? Because children are very smart and very powerful and they can think for themselves. And we assume that they can't, which is why we don't have these conversations with them. And so all of it has been... I like seeing this, like, from children, but at the same time, it saddens me that we have to put them in these positions, right? Like, why, like, it's fucked up.
And I think along with all this, right, and all this credit to children and, you know, them doing the work, also, unfortunately, comes a lot of adults taking advantage of kids, right? And, like, their naivete, right? And how... Nothing, I think, exemplified that to me more than, like, the U.S. Army or, like, the U.S. military, like, putting out that commercial about, like, we support March for Our Lives because, you know, the AK-47 or whatever, like, should only, you know, be used in war, right? And Emma, right, one of the, you know, faces of the March for Our Lives, right, posted that commercial up in their social media. And I don't think they had the language to see that that was hurtful and that that was violent, actually, right? It's beyond problematic, right? Because what are you saying? What is the military saying when they are like, you know, AK-47s shouldn't be used in the U.S., right? To inflict violence against our kids, right? Even though, you know, they hide the fact that they use them overseas, right? Or, like, you know, in foreign countries.
Yeah. Right? Well, in this ad, I don't even think they're hiding that. They're basically saying... I use this overseas, but it shouldn't be used at home against our children. Like, but it's totally okay if we do it to, like, brown and black children overseas. That's pretty much what it's saying. But, you know, Emma, they are young, like a lot of these children. And even though like they're on the right path and they know what they're talking about, they're like, they still need that guidance from adults to be like, hey, this is why, or like, they're still going to develop, right? And so I hope that some people explain that to Emma in a way that's not attacking them, because again, they're teens. So like, there are like, I think we've talked about this before about like call outs. I think we talked to, yeah. I don't know. I think we talked about it at UC Davis and how a lot of people attack people that are young for having like these problematic ideas that they're barely learning. So instead of like attacking them, we should be like guiding them into these conversations. So yes. So when I saw that, I was kind of like side eye, but I'm not like, wow, Emma's totally a piece of shit for sharing this, right? Because that is what the U.S. does. They, like, co-opt everyone's movements and organizing to use it for their benefit.
And that's called neoliberalism, right? Which means a lot of things, but in this case, it means, like, the co-opting of certain movements, right, to serve the government, right? It also means, right, like, imperialist investment and violence in other places, right, to destabilize, right, and to supposedly, like, help, right, aid, but in reality, it's just, like, about taking resources from countries that don't have the type of defense budget, right, and investment in violence that we do, right, as the U.S. I think very few places have seen this unique, like, ways, right, the neoliberalism has attacked them, right, as much as, like, Central America, right? Mm-hmm. And even recently as, like, Hillary Clinton's, right, campaign, we saw a lot of, like, Hillary Clinton is about women's rights, right? And yet, like, she was responsible for, like, the murder of, like, Berta Cáceres, right? And so I want to go more into that. And I think a part of having these conversations about Central America is, like, having someone who actually, like, knows her shit, right? Because as much as I want to talk, like, it's not, maybe not my conversation to lead, and also like, not my expertise, right? Mm-hmm. So we actually brought someone who's devoted a lot of their career to Central American issues, right? And ensuring that they are on the map, right, in the greater mainstream media, right? You might know them as Salva Cultura, right? Or maybe even Salvi Prince, right? But their name is Daniel Alvarenga, right? And they are journalists, right? They are a cultural critic. They are a social media presence, right? They talk about LGBT issues. They talk about, you know, women's issues, feminist issues throughout, you know, the greater Central American area, which is rarely covered, right? They're currently with AJ Plus, but previously ran Salva Cultura, right? A website that focused on Central American issues from a Salvadorian perspective. And so I would like us to welcome Daniel.
Is that Chicanisma and Queer Chicano Chisme?
Oh, I don't know her.
Yes, hello. You are here.
Hi, thanks for having me. Oh my God. Ruben promised that he was going to have me like ages ago and I thought it wasn't going to happen. But thank you for inviting a bitter beige.
Yes. Why are you dragging us like that? We always say we're going to do all these things and have all these people, and then we don't.
For the record, it's not my fault, right?
Okay.
Take responsibility. I'm holding you publicly accountable for okay.
But Daniel said you. Not having. Daniel said okay. Ruben.
You guys are taking up, like, a lot of space in Latinidad right now.
Yeah. No, so, like, we're having a white Latino on our podcast, so, like, white Latinxes, you don't have to
boycott us.
Can't be like, yeah, you know, we already talked about your homegirl Frida, right? I know you have some feelings, and, you know, this is how we, like, make amends,
yes,
right?
Yes, we are making amends. Solidarity.
Solidarity with white Latinos, right? They suffer too.
Thank you. So, like, going off your gun debate, I was thinking, like, you know, especially with, like, with that whole Marines or Army ad you were talking about, how, like, what's going on here, this domestic terrorism with guns and bombings, is just such a, like, the chickens coming home to roost, because the United States, you know, filled its armory with guns during the war. Like, we were, like, the second, we had the second most military aid from the U.S., except for Israel, for, like, most of our war. And so, you know, it's why we're here today. It's why I'm here today. My parents fled the war. And I just wanted to do a quick shout out. Today is 38 years since Archbishop Oscar Romero was killed in El Salvador. He is a Catholic priest who, like, stood up for us, part of liberation theology, and he was killed by the Salvadoran government for speaking out. And today's the anniversary, so I just wanted to shout out. The Salvis know who he is. But yeah, you know, U.S. intervention in Central America and neoliberalism, like, you know, we had this, like, war against, like, the government, the U.S.-backed government versus communists, and then, like, we had a peace process that was, like, really much co-opted by neoliberalism. You know, there's no peace. There is no peace. That's why there's, like, a refugee crisis at, you know, the U.S.-Mexico border, because it's still dangerous, Central America. And if anything, the danger has spread to other Central American countries. Like you said, Honduras had a coup that Hillary authored or okayed or whatnot. And Berta Cáceres called her out, like, hey, like, you know, your white liberal feminist fave is going to get me killed. And she did.
Yeah.
And, you know, now they're still having an election crisis that is going underreported, and it's a mess. It's a mess.
Yeah. And something that I think we've seen scapegoated a lot, right, have been, like, MS-13 gangs, mm-hmm. right? And now they've become, like, this weird symbol for, like all Latin American criminals, right? In a weird way. It's weird that they, like, focus on this, like, little, like, group, like, this little area, right, to just kind of target, like, the greater Central America. And I wonder what the...
Yeah, I wouldn't say they, you know, they're trying to pin it on, like, Latinxes, right? Yeah. But I feel like Latinxes are always weird. Like, no, that's those others.
Yeah.
Those other Central Americans. Like, I had a funny story about your hometown that I said I was going to bring up, Cassandra. So I was with a friend in El Paso, and I was meeting his family. And so, it was my ex. And so, I was meeting his family for the first time, and then they're like, "Oh, is he an Anglo-Saxon? He looks white." And I was like, "No, I popped out with the Spanish, like, hola." And they're like, "Oh, he's Mexican." And I was like, "No, my family's from El Salvador." And they're like, "Oh," and then, like, someone yelled, like, "Check his back for tattoos," which is, like, a reference for MS-13. I was just like, "Damn it!"
Wow, that's ugly. I'm sorry about that. That is not surprising at all. Not just because it's El Paso, just coming from any Mexican Chicanx person, mm-hmm. I feel.
Yeah, I was surprised I heard about us out there in El Paso, though. I was like, oh, I feel represented.
Yeah, see, we got it.
No, yeah, so that's being used a lot right now. And it's something I called out, like, last year, even before Trump took office. I was like, this is going to happen. Because he's already was making sort of these little dog whistles about MS-13. And now it's just like, you know, they're using it as an excuse to send refugee children back. Refugee children who are escaping violence from the gang, from recruitment. And in the case of lots of girls, like, sexual assault.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think something that needs to be said, right, when we talk about, like, children from being deported from to back to Central America, right, under Trump, is that, like, this would have happened under everybody's, yes. like, liberal fave too, right? Hillary Clinton, right? She went on record saying, like, you know, send them back to teach, you know, parents in Central America a lesson, right? So as much as we want to pin all this violence on Trump, it's not that it's not horrible. It's that, like, we're seeing it in a different light, right, than maybe we would not have called out if it would have happened under Hillary, right? Because mm-hmm. I feel like she would have sold it a different way to Latinxes. And there's more noise now, right, that Trump is this big, bad devil, right, that maybe Hillary could not have been painted as.
Yeah, you know, and there was a lot of folks, too, who were just saying, like, now you know what it feels like. When he called us rapists, you know, it was like he was also calling Central Americans rapists. He just couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's going really hard on Central Americans, especially Northern Triangle folks, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, who are known as, like, the problem countries right now. And it's sort of like, I think it's also because we're small and we're easy to pick on. So it feels like, oh, well, no one's going to come to their defense. And he's kind of right. He's kind of right. If it's not like us, then it's like, who else? But, you know, there's been more allyship because, you know, like, shit is really hitting the fan now. And people are just kind of like, okay, we need to pay attention a little bit more. At the same time, like, it's kind of frustrating because even in my job, like, I can't really feel like, you know, I feel like this is something that needs to be, like, discussed more and, like, really broken down. And it's only when Trump says something about Mr. Teen will people listen for 5 minutes. And it's just like, oh, Trump said something about them. Like, who are these? Like, you know, who's this world's most dangerous gang, which is what Nat Geo called them. And it's just kind of like, you know, it's hard because, and then on the Central American front, there's a lot of respectability politics. A lot of, every time he says something, like, the community goes back. It's like, there's more to us than MS-13. You know, not all Salvadorans are MS-13. I'm just kind of like, yeah, you know, like, I get it. Like, you are not an MS-13 member. You're an upstanding member of society. But at the same time, like, MS-13 comes from policing in the U.S. They were born in L.A., you know, because they experienced, like, racialized violence from the state and, you know, also xenophobia from other Chicano gangs. Like, you know, a lot of the old testimony of, like, the origins were just kind of like, you know, I was tired of being pushed around by Chicanos in LA, so, like, we formed a gang to protect ourselves. And I've gone through and seen these testimonies, so it's not like something I'm coming up with, like, have a grind to axe with Chicanx folks. It's just like the reality of it is complicated. And so to say that this is a problem that Central America is bringing over here is so just, it's just so lazy. It's so lazy. And, you know, if we send these kids back, if we send refugees back, if we deport people with the PS, people who are undocumented, don't even have the PS, if we send them back, like, they're going to be more vulnerable to the gang to either, like, be killed by them or join them. And it's just like, if he really cared about the MS-13 problem, he would give refugee status to every Central American person. But, you know, he doesn't, and he just wants them dead.
And I think you bring up something important. It's just like how the U.S. doesn't take responsibility for the mess it's made, right? And so MS-13 would not have existed without, you know, everything that led up to him, right? I think a lot of people give credit to, like, Ronald Reagan, even our own, like,
yeah,
Latinxes.
It was, right? Actually, you know, you could even go back before Ronald Reagan, Carter, who, like, Carter's the one that killed the priest I mentioned earlier, Monsignor Romero.
Yeah.
And was, like, part of the leading up. But, you know, Reagan is the one that really just, like, ramped up the violence. You know, colonial violence with Central America and the U.S. goes back at least, if not more, 100 years. Because once Spain came out, it's like the U.S. rolled in. And England. It's a whole long colonial story. So it's like, it's very much like, this is still like the aftermath of colonialism playing out in Central America. It's just like, now that the U.S. is, you know, putting its neoliberal spin on it, like, you know, if we had social programs in El Salvador, because, you know, we're part of CAFTA. I don't think people really know. It's actually DR CAFTA. It's basically like NAFTA and for Mexico, but it's with Dominican Republic and Central America. And so we have all these neoliberal policies. We have the dollar in our country. We're essentially like a neo-colony. And, you know, there's just, you know, we're being exploited by agribusiness, by, like, Canadian mining companies. There's just, like, people can't live off the land. They've been displaced. There's internal displacement. There's displacement towards the other Central American countries. And so then you have people whose basic needs aren't being met because of the neoliberal influence of the United States. And then they're surprised that there's violence, you know. They're surprised that people are turning to violence and trying to survive in this unsurvivable, like, environment. And then, so, you know, there's so many layers to this. There's so many layers to this. And it's just like, so much of it just goes unexplored because it's just like, oh, Trump said this about MS-13 and let's debunk this and then let's move on to his next victims. And it's just like, I don't know. At the very least, I see people coming together more in solidarity with Central Americans now. And Central Americans also, because we're not really united. You know, we're very multicultural and there's lots of racism and there's also lots of nationalism within ourselves. And so you're seeing, like, Central American Twitter impact this a lot.
And I think not a lot of people know, like, how to address that, I think. Because, I don't think a lot of people know what the fuck, constitutes Central America, right?
Yeah.
So people are like, what the fuck? Belize is part of Central America?
Belize. You know, I don't know a whole lot about Belize growing up because Belize is very race. And I think I think their name is K'Angela.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
On Twitter. They talk a lot about Belize and how it's erased from Latinidad because they had British colonizers. They had British colonizers. They speak English as an official language. But they're like right next to Mexico and Guatemala. And they very much have a Caribbean culture. And so, yeah, there's not a whole lot of visibility for them in other countries, too. You know, Salvadorans, we're the biggest. The reason you hear about Salvadorans so much is we're the biggest Central American group outside of Central America. And that's a large part to the war. We're the smallest in Central America. We don't have the biggest population there, but we make up the largest group in the U.S. And so we take up a lot of space within Central American issues because of that. And this always gets talked about within Central American Twitter. For those who don't know Central American Twitter, it's the Central American hashtag. It's like the watering hole for us on Twitter.
And it was begun by Wilfred.
So Wilfredo invented it, like kind of casually, like, and then but Saida, Central American Beauty, really promoted it.
Yeah, they would just retweet everything around that, right?
Yeah, so he invented it, and she did a lot of the ramping up and the building of it. And you know, I put my little two cents here and there. And you know, there's been other folks, but you know, we're relatively like, we're still coming into ourselves, and a lot of it is just sort of like in opposition to Mexican hegemony that like kind of binds us together.
And can you tell us a little bit about that for the people that are like, what does that mean? Why are you attacking Mexicans?
Yeah, you know, Mexican hegemony, the way I came about it, and actually I learned about Mexican hegemony from someone who was Mexican, a queer, non-binary Zapotec friend of mine. But basically, Mexican hegemony is sort of like the manifestation of Mexican nationalism kind of taking up all of the space within Latinidad, especially in the U.S. The way it manifests is, you know, when people talk about Latinxes, they assume it's Mexicans. Like, Latinx media is Mexican-centric. You see Mexican folks just mostly, you know. But also like on the personal level growing up, especially in the Southwest in LA, but I've experienced this, you know, in areas that were like what Chiganexes call Aslan the most.
Where me and Ruben
live. Where you and Ruben live, yes.
Well, we used to live, we got exiled.
Oh yeah, you guys are exiled. You know, growing up, like the discrimination was hard for, especially on my parents and my siblings, who they were all refugees. They all migrated here. I was born here later. And, you know, my dad has a Mexican accent. He has this whole backstory that he's from, like, Jalisco. And I think, like, my friend Virginia, shout out to Wishte on Twitter, was talking about, she wrote this essay, like, always say you're Mexican. And she talks about how, like, people in Central America will practice their Mexican accent listening to telenovelas because, you know, Televisa and Mexican media companies own most of the media in Central America. And, like, we don't have big movie houses. We don't have, like, big international, like, networks. We just don't. We're just tiny. We have some national media, and then it's Mexican media, and that's what it is. And then, you know, some dub American stuff. And, you know, people really do mimic the accent. And this is true now, but this is also true in the 80s when my mom came, and she tells me she was just, like, she was, when she was crossing Mexico, and she was at different places with my brother, because she came with a two-year-old. On her migration, and she was hated when my brother would speak, because my brother is just a little toddler, and the kids in Central America speak quick, and they start speaking earlier. They're not as babied, I feel like, as here. And so he was like saying, like, really salvy, in a salvy accent, just like saying things like he was like ese hijo puto no me quiso dar chicle, but like I can't even mimic it because like I don't even have a really Central American accent because of just growing up around like Mexican so much. I've just sort of adopted a more neutralized Central American accent, a more Mexican accent. Anyways, she didn't want to be outed by my little Salvadorian brother, or now older brother, because of his accent. She would mimic Mexican accent too, and not much has changed, I feel, because it's even more precarious now that there's more and more Central Americans coming than the 80s. there was probably even less, there's probably less xenophobia then. But even just growing up here, my mom even told me it was like very gendered because we were going through war, and so a lot of men died. Like, and so the gender ratios were off, and that's had a big impact on Salvadoran like family. But when she came and she was working with a bunch of like she's like white mestizas at her first job here in, it was in LA, and she told me that like they were just kind of like, oh, there's a salvadoreña, you know, she's a quita maridos and whatnot, and they just kind of they're just kind of like, you know, she's gonna try to sleep with her husbands, and she got like all this discrimination from like her her Latina supposed sisters, right?
Quita maridos is a homewrecker.
Yes, she's a homewrecker. There were, and you know, and there's, because there was this assumption that like she had no man because of the war, and that she's just trying to come up, and that, you know, I don't know. It was really strange, and you know, I'm a man, so I haven't really unpacked that so much. But she tells me these things. And there was just a lot of discrimination, and you even see it in Chicano media from the time. There is there's a show called there was a movie with Cheech and Chong, I think it was like Born in East LA. There's a scene where like there's a Salvadoran woman, and they called her like a disco bunny, and they just assumed that she was like this hypersexual, and like, I don't know, the way the xenophobia plays out in LA is like very significant. Like, I can always tell who's like Salvadoran from Los Angeles area, or maybe SoCal in general, because we do have a bit of a chip on our shoulder when it comes to having to grow up in like the biggest Mexican diaspora in the U.S., which is also the biggest Salvadoran diaspora in the U.S. And so there's a lot of tension there that goes back to like MS-13 and the other maras that no one talks about.
Yeah, and so everything that you're unpacking right now, for a lot of Mexicans or Chicanx, is probably I don't want to say it's like the first time they're hearing it, because Central Americans always say these things online. A lot of Mexicans and Chicanx like refuse to unpack that for themselves because
they refuse to engage other Latinxes. Is something I've seen a lot. It's Mexicans follow other Mexicans. Yes or no mas. Mm-hmm. That's it, right?
Yes, exactly. So as someone who was that was wrapped in like xenophobia and Mexican nationalism, you know, like I talk a lot about how I used to be like that typical like Chicana Aslan Mecha person. And Daniel, you know, Daniel, everyone had me blocked at one point on Twitter for talking yes, about this. I did. But I think it's important to talk about, because I always talk about like, oh, I used to be this and I used to be that, and I used to like say these, but I never really like go into detail about it. And so I think it's like important for me also to say like specific things that I've said, right? And so yeah, in regards to Central American xenophobia, something that the Chicano politics and ideology promote is a lot of xenophobia towards Central Americans. And that doesn't necessarily look like, I wasn't necessarily like on Twitter saying like fuck Central Americans, but it was like in a more subtle way, even though it wasn't really subtle mm-hmm. to actual Central Americans, right? So it was kind of mm-hmm. like
it was non-Mexican privilege. That was the discourse of the day.
Yes. So it's like, how do I explain it? So it's like the Chicano movement and politics, etc., it's very obviously centered around Mexicanness, right? And so I think that when people Mexicans, Chicanxs discover the Chicano movement, like they're really empowered by it, right? Like I was empowered by that because I didn't really feel like I was.
You were neither aquí ni allá.
Oh my god, stop. Yeah, like, I, you know, like I talk a lot about like white feminism, black feminism. And so like the Chicana movement was where I thought like, oh, this is like me and this is like my history, right? And so I did feel connected and empowered by that. But I think one of the biggest problems with that is that people get stuck in there, right? So it's not only are you getting fed like nationalism and anti-blackness and xenophobia, it's that it doesn't progress from there, which the Chicana movement hasn't progressed. It's like been that way and it's stayed that way. And so when you learn about it, there's nothing that's like telling you to unpack these things that were problematic. And so when you're like, when you realize, and I took a Chicano studies class that I got a C in that Ruben was making fun of me for, there was a lot of growth.
The great Chicanismo, I got a C.
Yeah, I got a C.
In Chicano.
Stop. A lot of
deplatform her.
Stop. A lot of the girls and that were taking that class were young girls who had never really been exposed to like talks about race or class or history, right? And so I was sitting in there and I would like thought it was interesting that they their politics changed and that they're, you know, when you go through a moment where you're like, wow, I've been a victim of racism and I have the language to unpack this. So I think that's powerful. But there was no follow-up to that. And so when there's no follow-up, you're like, oh, I'm oppressed and no one is oppressed like me and therefore I can't be an oppressor. And so that's where I feel like a lot of Chicanxs get stuck, where they're like, wow, I experience racism and I learn all these things about myself and like I think that's empowering, but then we don't realize how we are also the oppressor. And so a lot of Chicanxs don't want to acknowledge that we have privilege, even though we're Mexican or Mexican descent, that we have privilege within the Latinx umbrella. Right? So like that is a privilege to be centered in every conversation, to be seen and represented, even though we have these conversations about who's represented, who isn't. It is Mexican. Even if like the actors that get casted, the Latinx that get casted, they are played like they're playing Mexican characters, but they're not Mexican, right? And
yeah, I was about to say, like, one of the biggest examples of this is how America Ferrera, right, played a fucking, you know, an ugly Betty. She played a Mexican woman, even though she's straight up like Central American, right?
She's enduring.
And I bet a lot of people right now were like, what? She's not fucking Mexican. Yeah. Right? I didn't know she was either until recently. But that's the thing, that it's like you assume everyone is Mexican. And so one of the things that, because I said a lot of awful things on Twitter, but one of the things that I want to bring up that I do remember, because I know you had brought up that I had made a thread, that one I don't remember, even though I'm not denying it, I'm sure it's on there. But there was this one narrative that I promoted myself, but that I see a lot, that was like, you know, when Central Americans or non-Mexican Latinx are like, I'm not Mexican, right? And then Mexicans are like, wow, what's wrong with being Mexican? Like, how dare you attack us? And like, we're like the last thing that you want to be associated with. And everyone hates us. And like, I posted like this thing. And I remember it was like this image that was, it had like the Dominican flag. And it was like, you know, those keep calm things, right? Like keep calm. But it was like, keep calm. I'm not Mexican. I'm Dominican. That was like the image, right? And I made like this awful shitty thread about like, wow, like that exact thing, like, oh, no one wants to be so associated with Mexicans because we're like the most oppressed out of all the Latinx. Like, I actually said these things, which are like embarrassing now, but it's because that is like the narrative, right? That no one is as oppressed as you, and if people are calling you out, it's because they quote unquote hate you and not because like you fail to acknowledge like why are they saying these things. You just feel attacked. And one of the most recent things that I wanted to highlight was, so Latina Rebels, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, like an account online, right? They posted like this very basic post that was like, none of the contributors of Latina Rebels are Mexican, right? Like very fucking basic post. And they have probably now like 2,000 comments that I was going through, like the majority of them. And they were just all Chicanxs and Mexicans like saying the exact same things that I said a few years ago on Twitter, which was, wow, so what's wrong? Like a lot of them were just like, what's wrong with being Mexican? And like, why are you excluding us? And we're all Latinxs, and why can't like stop dividing us, and et cetera. But I'm sure you've heard all of these comments before, Daniel.
Oh God. Since growing up, you know, like a lot of times like people would minimize it and being like, oh, you know, you're not that different from us or whatever, like, you know, stop bringing attention to it. You know, in very many situations growing up, I would just tell people I'm Mexican just to just make it easy, because like sometimes it's just like, or even speaking in Salvadoran or voseo or like Salvadoran caliche, which is our like what we call our slang, is just like, I just tone it down, because then it becomes a conversation. It might lead to xenophobia, might not, and I just like, you know, in some situations, and this is more when I was younger and I didn't have this like strong Central American consciousness. But yeah, you know, and I will say this too, like, and someone called me in who, Afro Catracho back in the day, when I said, you know, like, you know, Central Americans have to go and pass for Mexicans. And like, you know, that's even a privilege in itself. Like the only ones that like, cause you know, Mexicans will take us in their fold if we're mestizo or white. And, you know, and we can navigate Mexicanidad, and, like, you know, someone who's, like, an Afro-Central American can't. So, you know, and that very much builds on Mexican nationalism. But, you know, going back to the Latino rebels thing, I was in the comment section too, fighting people. Cause like, you know, how could I not? I can't control myself when these things come up. It's just like, okay, I have to say something, even though I shouldn't, because I'm going to get like a headache. But, you know, some guy was calling me cerote, and cerote is like this slur that Mexicans have taken for us, and especially in California. Basically, and I get called this if I'm wearing like a Salvadoran jersey and I'm like in a Mexican neighborhood or just around a Mexican person, like I'm liable to be called cerote. Like, I feel anxiety wearing Central American stuff in California because of this. But cerote, it's actually a caliche word, which is our speak in El Salvador, and it means turd. It just means turd. Paso mierda un cerote. And we sometimes use it as dude. Sometimes we use it disparagingly, like you're a piece of shit, you know, depends on the tone. But like a lot of Mexican folks in LA area, especially, like have picked up on this word of ours and then use it against us, which is, it's just like, it's like the insult's not even original. And so like, you know, you say this word and I was like, I'm sorry, I'm arming the little Chicanx folks that listen to you with this word. You don't say this word. But you know, you get called this word and it's just like, it's weird because it's like an appropriated slur of like your own dialect against you. And it's just like, someone called me that in the Latina rebels comments, and just like, no one moderated that or anything. It's just like, okay, so now I have to deal with this person. But yeah, you know, it's just, you know, you can either be meek and just, you know, go with the flow and be like, you know, we're just like Mexicans, you know, or never say like, you know, don't call me Mexican, or you can speak out and, you know, get abuse. And it's just like, you know, there's also like a lot of half Central Americans, half Mexican folks. It's just like two. And, you know, you don't see them doing this, you know, it's just like, if you're not Mexican, you're not Mexican. And, you know, that's all, like, that's all it is. But people turn it into like this big pedo, and like, you know, it's so old for me. It's just like, and sometimes it doesn't even faze me because I'm just kind of like, oh, I remember when I had the discussion like at lunch in high school with someone. And yeah,
I think you were asking recently, like, where did you first learn about Mexican hegemony? Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like, I learned about it in high school, right? I talk up to Daniel about this all the time, and I didn't think that I ever, like, not that I'm like so fucking like, oh, Ruben's so holy or anything, but I just don't think that I ever harbored like these xenophobic feelings, right? And it was mainly because all my friends were like Cuban, and my best friend was Garifuna, right, growing up, and Salvadorians, and it was like, it felt like all the people who were othered like were in my posse, right? And so, but I saw it all the time, and they would explain to me like what was happening and how they were feeling, and but I didn't know what the fuck like the word was until like 25 maybe, and I went, when I went back to college, and people were it was Central Americans and indigenous folks who were like, yeah, this is what Mexican nationalism is, and this is what Mexican hegemony is, mm-hmm. right? And so I guess I was very blessed to be queer and like ostracized in this way, because I don't feel like, and I'm from Southeast LA, right? Like you mentioned, like that's like the biggest like Mexican like diaspora in the US, mm-hmm. right? And so even though there's very like in Southeast LA, there's like a whole like area where it's primarily Salvadoran folks and other Central American mm-hmm. folks, right? You know, shout out to Otis Street. But if you didn't look for them, right, and there's mm-hmm. you can completely like miss like connecting with people who are Central American, yeah. right? And I think, and then I think nowhere was this more clear to me than when Jessica was telling me about like the area where she grew up, and I'm like, I've never been there. Like mm-hmm. I've been all over the, you know, I'm from LA, so I'm just like, but I've never been there.
She's from like Echo Park or MacArthur.
I think like yeah,
Echo yeah. Park. Yeah.
And so I'm like, I don't really go there, and that's the case for a lot of people in mm-hmm. LA, and like primarily like Central American, like where the diaspora is
on. Yeah, no, like, you know, before gentrification, we would go visit people in Echo Park because that was a big Salvi neighborhood, and then we'd also visit people like in like Pico Union area, which is like little Central America basically, and you know, to get our diaspora fill. But I grew up like 20 miles outside of 25 ish miles outside of LA in a super working class immigrant Mexican community, mostly Mexican American, and I have this experience of like kind of opposite you, like all my friends are Mexican, and people accuse me of hating Mexicans, so I'm just kind of like I never use this, but I can be like literally like all my friends are, and like I'm going to like a wedding for one of them like tomorrow, and it's just like you know it's weird because like so it was I was assumed Mexican all the time and all my friends were, and I grew up where just like everyone was assumed Mexican, and so like I grew up and like I found out people were Central American later. I like left my hometown, and people on Facebook like coming to me and being like, oh, I'm Honduran, I'm Salvadoran, I'm Nicaraguan, and thank you for, you know, speaking up about us on so-and-so platform. And I'm just like, we grew up together, like we had all these classes, like I never knew you were Central American. And so like, you know, this Mexican hegemony also like keeps us from creating our own communities. Yeah,
because it keeps you from speaking about those identities, right? I think one of your essays about like Voceo covered how like people lost and that accent and that like language, right? And for people who don't know what Voceo is, like, what is
it? Yeah, so Voceo is it's a way of speaking. Instead of tú, we use vos. It's not vosotros from Spain, before someone from Spanish 101 comes in here. Instead of tú, like tú estás, we say vos sos. Tú tienes, we would say vos tenés. And it's just a way of speaking. It's a second person plural pronoun to get all grammatical. And basically, in a place like Southern California, where like the other Voceo people are going to be Central American most likely, because Voceo is also known in for like Argentina and other parts of the Spanish speaking world, but in SoCal, Voceo is associated with Central Americans, and you know it's a strong marker of Central Americanness, and so that was like the first thing to go with my family. Like no one in my family uses that anymore. It's like, imagine if you were to stop saying tú and just replace it with another random word, which is like a word you use every day constantly. And I didn't know what that was growing up until I went to El Salvador as a child. I got to go, and everyone was talking about like vos this, vos that, and I was like, who's this vos person? They're like everywhere, and they're like, the vos is you. And I was like, whoa.
The vos is all of us.
Yeah.
The vos is inside of us.
Yeah. So, so then I went to school, I studied linguistics, unpacked this, and you know.
Ah, she studied linguistics.
Yes, and just for boss. And then like I felt calm about it. And then like, you know, and now I know how to speak it. I've gone to Sabor, I talked to Central Americans. But for me, it was just like a small little part of reclaiming, you know, it's still like a colonial language and whatever. So like, I don't give Voceo discourse as much part of like my platform like I used to, but like it's a quirky little thing that can, you know, that's a symbol of the tension between like, you know, Mexican Americans and Central American Americans.
Yeah, and I think for some people, maybe like in the East Coast, it might be like, what the fuck are they talking about? Like, it's like Dominican people here, or like Puerto Ricans,
yeah,
or Cubans like in Florida, right? And so they might be like, they're talking about something that I cannot relate to. But I think, from my understanding too, is that like Mexican hegemony, although it impacts the Southwest, I think that it's most tangible when we talk about media.
Yes.
Right? Like, even though like, you know, all these populations are huge over there, right? They like the novelas, I mean, Univision is still like the biggest, you know, fucking media monster, right? And so just to like give people like some notion, right, that might sit with them in a way that they can understand, right? Because you also talked about one time how there's like a like strong Salvadorian presence in DC.
Yes, this is it. So I spent a lot of time in DC last year.
Mírala.
And I'm planning to go back at some point next year. And DC is really unique because it's like the only city where Salvadorans are a majority. You know, and we're the fourth largest Latinx group in the country. A lot of people don't know that. Not that it matters so much, really. But in LA, you know, it's the biggest diaspora, but like because it's also the biggest Mexican diaspora, like Mexican hegemony is all around. And then, you know, and in places like New York and stuff, there's a lot more like Caribbean Latinx folks, and it's a lot more of an international mix. That I don't from what I can tell, I don't know if there's a whole lot of hegemony there. It's not something I can speak to from another group, but in DC I feel so inauthentic because they're speaking like Salvadorans, and I'm like coming at them with like my like Central American / Mexican influenced Spanish. But yeah, no, like I go over there and I'm just kind of like, oh, it's really Salvadoran here. And it's so random to me. But you know, it is something people experience. Cause like we grew up with like mariachis. We grow up with, Mexican music and television. And I remember one time you asked me when we first started hanging out, Ruben was, you asked me like, who's a famous Salvadoran, like singer or something. And I was just kind of like, oh, we don't really have any like mega famous ones. And you're like, that's so sad. And I was like, to me, it wasn't sad. I mean, I guess, you know, on some level, but to me, I was just kind of like, it's just what it is. Like, you know, like we listen to a lot of like reggaeton from like Caribbean. We listen to a lot of cumbia from Colombia, and like, and we listen to a lot of Mexican like mariachis and corridos and stuff like that. So to me, it was just kind of like, never really thought about it. And then, you know, there's also like a lot of Central American music, like, you know, Afro, Jamaican, Afro-Panamanians invented reggaeton, garifunas on, you know, the Caribbean coast invented punta and stuff.
Punta, that's what I knew as like Central American music.
Yeah, you know, and Me Llamo Yana on Twitter, she's garifuna, and for those who don't know, garifuna are like an Afro-Indigenous people from the Caribbean that are in Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and I think Nicaragua. Yeah. And they invented this genre of music that is called punta. And a lot of people attribute it to Central America, attribute it even to like mestizos or mestizo Hondurans, and it's not. But you know, like you said, you thought it was like general Central American.
Yeah. Well, I learned from it from my garifuna friend, oh, okay, right? But she also had like the shame about like being garifuna, right? Because mm-hmm. even in like Central America, like she experienced a lot of like racism, right? Her family did, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes back to like what I said, like, you know, the like some, like a lot of like mestizo folks from Central America running with the Mexican hegemony discourse, cause it affects them too. But like, you know, Mexican nationalism and hegemony was really built off the exclusion of Afro-Mexicans and indigenous folks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always kind of want to rein in Central Americans too a little bit, like, okay, like El Salvador is probably, as far as being like a mestizo supremacy, is like very much on par, if not worse than Mexico, because Mexico obviously should be getting a lot of shit for like what it does to its Afro-Mexican indigenous populations. But like El Salvador is like such a genocidal place, and you know, we have this whole myth in El Salvador that we don't have any Afro-Salvadorans. That's untrue, but we had laws that like prohibited them coming to the country, and nobody talks about this so much. And then we also have this myth, because we don't have a Caribbean coast, we're the only Central American nation without a Caribbean coast. And so like a lot of people in Salvador say like that's why we don't have black people in Salvador, and it's just like, again, untrue. And if you want to know more, the account that probably that does a lot more with this is Central American Beauty on Twitter.
And on Instagram too.
And so like, you know, that's where I follow them. Mexican hegemony and talking about it is important, but you also have to like be more critical of just nationalism, even, you know, Central American in general, all nationalism in Latin America. Because it comes from the same place.
So nationalism should be unpacked on multiple levels, right? Because who gets left out, like who gets like mm-hmm. shut down, and who has like all the like resources, right? I think even recently, right, like in Brazil, we saw like the queer black politician, mm-hmm. right, who was murdered, right, Marielle Franco, right? And it's another way, right, that people erase, right, black bodies from mm-hmm. just existence, right? Mm-hmm. It's further colonizations, further imperialism, and a continuation of all these like violences that have it existed for time eternal, right?
Mm-hmm.
That yeah. a lot of us ignore for the sake of feeling like we are the most oppressed.
Yeah.
I think.
And I'm afraid of that happening with Central Americans too. And I'm getting a little tired of the Mexican hegemony stuff too, because like in the discourse, like, because I feel like I did it like almost 10 years ago on Tumblr, and I'm like, we're still having these discussions. And obviously like Mexican American folks, Chicanx folks need to be reined in.
Yeah.
When it comes to this, but, you know, I think part of the reason Central Americans and Mexicans get into it the most in terms of like this tension is because we're literally attached. Like, you know, we're literally attached. Like, you know, it always comes up with Dia de los Muertos and Coco. It's just like this, and you've talked about it in past episodes, so I don't want to retread too much about it. But this always, it always comes like, this is a Mexican holiday, and then it's just like, but we have it too, and, you know.
Nobody wants to talk about why.
Yes, why, and, you know, the indigenous influence. And so it's just like, it's just kind of like, with the between Central America and Mexico, like, there's tension, like, historic tension that goes back to some, like, from the colonization, like, you know, Mexico tried to, like, back in the old colonial days, tried to, because Central America
tried to come up on y'all.
They tried to like annex parts, and I think Chiapas actually was part of the Central American Republic, which is also a white supremacist settler colonial state. But there's always been this like tension between like the elites, the, you know, from Mexico and Central America, like divvying up the stuff, and so like it's very historical.
It's messy too, even the way the lines are drawn.
Yeah,
right. I think I still don't have the language to explain, but like a lot of southern Mexico, right, has this like odd like understanding sometimes of like the way that Central Americans like discuss Mexican hegemony.
Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, I learned about Mexican hegemony from someone who's from southern Mexico, who's indigenous from Oaxaca, because of they had a perspective on how the state excluded them by their identities. And, you know, who are the most vulnerable in Mexico? Like, you know, there's Afro-Mexicans, there's indigenous folks, and then there's like migrants. And it happens to be that a lot of the migrants come from Central America, but they also come from everywhere.
Yeah, like Haiti is something that like people are ignoring right now, that people are like immigrating to Mexico from Haiti, right? And I think one of the things that a lot of Mexicans, because they feel disempowered in the U.S., they feel like, you know, this oppression is worldwide, right? But it's pretty much like a U.S. thing. Like, in Mexico, we have power, especially as mestizos, right? And as white Latinxes, right? And nowhere is this more evident than, like, how we erase, like, Central American immigration, right? Through Mexico, right? Because everybody has to cross through Mexico to get to the U.S. Maybe not everybody, but most people, right? That's like the most common way to get across. And so they ignore the violence that like Mexicans inflict, not only via xenophobia, but also state violence, right?
And what people don't realize is that like a lot of Central Americans, if they push back on Mexico and like, you know, Mexican hegemony, sometimes it does come from a place of like maybe they're being messed up too. And it's just like, but in terms of like, you know, so I know some people who will really go hard on Mexico for just like just no reason, but there's a lot of trauma there. Like, there's a lot of trauma there. Like my dad, and this is 1980, this was like, or 1980s, and he spent a week in a Mexican jail when he was crossing, and he was sent back and had to do it over again. And, you know, that was his like first sort of introduction of like what awaited him coming to Mexican communities here. And there's a lot of like, my parents don't like traveling to Mexico because it reminds them of the journey. And so I think people also have to acknowledge, you know, if a Central American is saying something off the wall about like Mexico that may seem like irrational to you, it's just like think about like what they've, the stories they've heard or even lived them themselves.
Yes. And I wanted to note that I don't know if it's a question that I have for you or a comment, but it's like, for you're both talking about how you came to learn these things, right? And for me, it was obviously on Twitter. Like, I had to be dragged. I've been dragged multiple times, right? And it was mostly,
I probably dragged you.
Huh? Yeah, you probably,
well, I probably blocked you and then dragged
you. I don't know. You probably didn't drag me at all. You were like, this bitch isn't even worth dragging. But for example, like, for me, it was like, I would say all this nonsense, right? All this xenophobia bullshit. And then I feel like it was mostly like non-Mexican Latinx that had to drag me, obviously, because the people that were in like my Twitter circle were just like me. They were Chicanexes too. And so that's how I learned it, right? Obviously, like Central Americans had to be the ones to like call this shit out, right? Because who else is going to do it? And so I guess like the question I had is like, for me, like now that I know these things, like I try to like not necessarily speak on it myself because that's not my fucking experience, but like to share articles or retweet Central American Voices, for example. And like sometimes I have made a few posts about it because I also think, sadly, like some people don't listen to Central Americans, but they do listen to like fellow Mexicans or fellow Chicanexes, which is problematic within itself, right? But I wanted to, I guess, what do you feel is the most, the best way, I don't even know if best is the word, for other Mexican Chicanexes to like check themselves and to be better allies? And I hate the word allies, you know, for anybody at all, like men allies or white allies, because it's like that word itself, whenever I see that, I'm like, get the fuck out of here. Because actions speak louder than words, obviously. But what do you think is the best way for Mexican or Chicanexes to, who are listening to this right now, to be like, oh, wow, I've done this or I've thought these things. Like, how do I do better without crossing this line? Right. Because it's also like then Mexicans and Chicanexes start using your labor and your words to say it instead of uplifting your voices. Right. Because I guess the bottom line that I want to say is that what I know now, as far as xenophobia and nationalism towards Central Americans, is from actual Central American voices, right? And so I do want to say that whatever I learned was not because I did it myself, right? It was from Central Americans doing that labor. And it's not necessarily probably labor aimed at towards Chicanexes. It's just because that's your experience and you're putting it out there. And so I did benefit from that, right? From like Central American voices.
Yeah, no, I remember, like, because I remember you doing that stuff, and I was just like, oh, growth. And then, like, you know, I unblocked you. But you know, you're right, there's been a lot of performativeness in including Central Americans more in like Mexico centric platforms. And I don't want it to just be performative, because, you know, now I feel like now it's just like, okay, the cool thing now is to like let Central Americans, you know, speak, or to like, you know, speak on xenophobia towards them. And, you know, I was like, I'm not saying stop doing that. But also, like, it doesn't always happen on the timeline. Mm-hmm. It's just like everything else, you know, you're going to hear like your like Mexican, like dad or partner or someone, say something xenophobic, not in front of a Central American, but thinking he can sit in front of you because you guys are from the same backgrounds, you guys are cool, and you guys can make these jokes in front of each other, and checking someone when, you know, when it's not an opportunity just for retweets, it's just like, you know, behind the scenes. And, you know, and I see this all the time, because like I get like, you know, you know, people don't think I'm Central American all the time, because it, depending on how I speak. And so, like, sometimes I'll get people thinking I'm Mexican and make these things. And this is like a recurring thing with me a lot. And it also helps that, because I'm like a white mestizo, that they feel comfortable. And they'll say these, like, really, like, even racist things. And then be like, oh, I didn't realize you were, you know, Salvadoran. And then I have to pull them aside. And it's just kind of like, they're probably doing these things, like, with each other, you know, behind closed doors, making these jokes all the time. And that's also why I'm like, so like, I'm Salvadoran, just so you know, so you don't say anything. But you know, listening, and don't just listen to me. Like, I don't really want to be this poster child for this stuff, because it stresses me out. But like, there's a lot of other like voices. Like, I recommend Central American Beauty. I recommend, Yana, who she's Garifuna, she's Me Llamo Yana on Twitter, invented the Central American shirt, that all of Central American Twitter's wearing. Just go on the Central American Twitter hashtag, see who's talking, listen to, like, you know, Garifuna folks, Afro Central Americans, indigenous Central Americans. Listening, like, I think listening, like, even if you don't have to say, even like listening to me is better than a performative call out. Obviously, when someone who's Mexican is saying something problematic, you know, if you have time, drag them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the least. As I think listening is always number one, because sometimes you don't, people don't need your input, especially if you're not part of that marginalized group. So I think just listening, but also obviously there, like in that, we're bringing up, for example, that Post Latina Rebels. If you're Chicanx or Mexican, that would have been your chance to go in there. And there were, you know, there were, I did see people that were like, hey, I'm Chicanx, I'm Mexican. And I, they're, you know, but there could have been more, right? Like that's yeah. probably like one way that you can go in there and use your privilege and check other Chicanx, Mexicanx, but, and Mexicans. But also I think the overstepping is like, I think for me, for myself, because for example, when I was on Twitter and I followed a lot of Black feminists and I learned a lot from Black feminists, there was like this thing where I didn't know how to stay in my lane, where I was like, oh, because I have friends that are Black and I understand like what they're saying, I thought like I could comment on these Black issues because I quote unquote understood, but I'm not fucking Black and I'm never gonna understand that, right? And so there's also that. So obviously if there's, yes, you're listening to Central American voices, but sometimes they don't need your fucking input. And second of all, you're never going to know about that experience. So how much can you actually talk about that?
Yeah, and it's hard because a lot of us who are Central American, they feel like we can't speak out because especially if you have like a platform, you're Central American, you're careful about talking about Mexican hegemony because you feel like your base is Mexican, and a lot of people are using that against Latina rebels. It's kind of like, well, you know, you say that, but like, who's actually reading you? And sort of just like, and so like, you know, it can be hard for some Central Americans because, like, you know, especially if, you know, they have a platform and they rely on that, they don't want to alienate all the Chicanx folks, and so they're stuck in this like, what do I do kind of thing. And I've been there, you know. I also don't care as much anymore, and so I'm just kind of like, I'm gonna alienate you and talk about my stuff. But like, yeah, I don't know. It's definitely, there's definitely a power dynamic there, and it's just like, you know, because a good example of like what I was talking about is just like America Ferrera. We brought her up earlier. She did on her show one time, someone on her new show, Superstar, was just like, her boss on the show, she works like at a Walmart, called her Mexican, and she's like, I'm Honduran. And I was like, that's the first time I saw her like affirm her Honduranness, which is like, even though I'm like not Honduran, like Hondura is just like a sibling.
Yeah.
And I felt like, oh my God, like I'm seen. And at the same time, like she was pro-Hillary.
She was so pro-Hillary. I was about to say that. Mm-hmm. Fuck her.
Yeah. And she, and she didn't call out Hillary for Berta Cáceres. She never mentioned Berta Cáceres. And, yeah.
And there's so much erasure. And even, like, we were talking about, like, performative, like, Chicanxes. And I think I saw a lot of that in discussions about TPS, right? A lot of us were like, what about Haiti? And, like, all this shit, right? Yeah. And you brought up some stuff about, like, if y'all really cared about Haiti, we would have bought it up, like, when shit was hitting the fan, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, a lot of Chicanx folks were calling, like, out Central Americans for not including Haiti enough, which is valid, because, you know, we don't, as Central Americans, include Black people in general. And it felt very performative, but at the same time, just like, Haiti was the first TPS country that was on the chopping block with the Trump administration. And, like, it got no like attention, and then slowly, like, the mestizo majority countries were about to lose it too, and that's when a lot of it came. And then also Salvadorans was the biggest, the Besa population, finally there was some noise, and there still even wasn't that much noise, and a lot of people pointed out this kind of like, you know, DACA and Tepeze, like people advocate for DACA because it's young kids. It's usually like a more,
more respectable,
you know, demographic that is covered under it. And, we did a story at AJ Plus where we interviewed, Jose, and he talked about how he has DACA and his mom has TPS. And it's just like, you know, I want to see as much attention,
What's Jose?
Jose, he's on social media, but he was part of one of our videos, and he's a Salvador immigrant who has leukemia. And, you know, he depends on his mother with the PS for health insurance. And he said something along the line, and he's queer. And he had something along the lines, like, if they're going to advocate for something for DACA, they need to do something for the best and also the other non-status having undocumented folks. So it's like there's this hierarchy of these like legal statuses, but like fun fact, it's like TPS, the structure for TPS, for DACA, I mean, comes from TPS. Like, it's basically a work permit, and you won't get deported, but you can't travel back to your country necessarily. And it's a gray area that like the government throws at you. And, you know, DACA was modeled after TPS, and TPS, now lots of countries are on it. The first TPS though, my sister was on it, was like for the war. It was like right before the war was going to end. And like, it was like a win from the sanctuary movement of the '80s. And that's another thing. We talk about sanctuary cities. Central Americans are erased. The reason sanctuary cities exist, or like the concept in modern times in terms of like the last like 30 years, is because Reagan's administration didn't give Nicaraguans, didn't give Guatemalans, didn't give Salvadorans refugee status, even though he was messing up our countries. Because to give us refugee status is to admit that his like millions and billions of dollars in aid to our countries was wrong. And so then you had, you know, churches and folks, you know, speaking up and offering their homes to us. And like, you know, like I was housed through the sanctuary movement, like in the early 90s, and you know, before I was born, my parents in the late 80s. And so the genesis of the modern sanctuary movement with Central Americans is kind of erased. And it's also part of like, you know, Central Americans have contributed to Chicanismo, but like you never see it.
Yeah. And so for folks who don't know what TPS is, like what is it?
Oh my God. It's a temporary protected status. And it's usually given for natural disaster and war. Basically it means your homeland is unlivable. And so you get to stay here for an undetermined amount of time. Yeah. For many people, it's been at least 20 years.
Yeah, that's a lot. And that's a lot to hold too. And I think as part of the TPS conversation, you've also talked about, I'm not sure if you started the hashtag Salvi War Trauma, which yes. Then evolved into Central American War Trauma. Yeah,
Salvi War Trauma and then Centam War Trauma. So for those of you who don't know, I'm occasionally on the camera for AJ Plus Español, and I talk about Salvi stuff mostly. And I was in the middle of filming a video talking about MS-13, because Trump brought it up, and I was sort of going to clap back a little bit, and my dad was scared. He was just like, I don't want you putting your face in front of the camera, because, you know, journalists get targeted, you know, and this comes from the war. Like, we would get, you know, journalists still die in Latin America a lot, and, you know, during the war, they went after them, and so he was very scared, and, you know, this is the government that created that scenario. So he's very scared. It's just like, you know, you're speaking out the government and you're putting your face out there. Like, I don't want you to do that. And that comes from his war trauma. Like, you don't speak out. Like, you know, you would be killed for holding a red book because our army was illiterate. They just knew communism was bad. Red equals communism. Red book equals a communist book. And so, like, that's the kind of environment we grew up in. And it's hard to unpack. Like, our parents hold a lot of trauma in that, like, influences our generation. And so I started Salvi War Trauma. My friend Esther, who's Salvadoran Mexican, actually did the first hashtag, but it was tied to like my little testimony tweet, and then everyone ran with it. I didn't expect it to. It's not a conversation I even wanted to start, and then I felt ready to talk about at that moment. But people really needed this outlet, and then to be more inclusive of, especially Nicaragua and Guatemala, who also had wars. So it became Centam War Trauma. And also Hondurans, they're literally the country between all three of us, militarized along with us. And that's why Honduras is like going through what it's going through right now. So like, just like, you know, people talking about how like, their moms didn't dress as feminine because, you know, back then you don't want to attract attention. You don't want to get raped by the death squads that Reagan was paying for. And, you know, just torture and the psychological trauma of, like, holding it all in and never seeing a mental health professional. And there's also growing up, there was always a stereotype of Salvadorans is, like, that we're crazy. And that we're, like, machete-wielding, like, really hot-tempered, you know, people. And violent. And, you know, we've experienced so much violence. And, you know, my generation who's, like, especially my generation who's a bit removed from the conflict is starting to talk about it. Like, how has it shaped our lives? Like, we've never had that space to talk about it. And, it was honestly, for me, it was honestly too much to read, because I grew up with these testimonies from my parents, and then, like, it was a lot. And I encourage some people to check out #SentamWarTrauma and #SalviWarTrauma if they want to know more.
And so you brought up that you're, like, not always ready for having these conversations. Do you ever feel forced to have to talk about this and, yeah, like, take up this mantle and, like, journalism?
Yeah, you know, there's not a lot of Salvadoran journalists and Central American journalists in the field, so we rarely get to be on that end. And even then, I have a struggle, like, in terms of getting my stories covered and getting to pitch my stories and getting it covered. It's my own internal struggle within the whole industry. But, you know, a lot of people look up to me, and I'm just kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just trying to get it out there. You know, I'm just trying to get people to talk about the things we need to be talked about. But I also don't want to bear the brunt. I don't want to be the only one, you know. But people always, you know, I always want to, like, delete my Twitter and just, like, quit because of the trolling or whatnot, or because of the pressure. And people are just kind of like, you know, thank you for bringing this up. Thank you for bringing this up. And, like, you know, I am like, you know, working behind the scenes to make sure, like, I don't want to be the only one. But it's just like, I hate this. There's this whole notion sometimes where there could only be one Central American, or there can only be one, you know, voice. And it's just like, ugh, like, I don't want people to make me the voice for Central American issues, because I can only really, my range is really only with El Salvador, because that's my experience. A little bit the Northern Triangle, Honduras and Guatemala, because, like, I've had family who lived there, and, like, you know, they're right next to us, and their history for me is very intertwined, and I know about them. But, like, you know, we're like I said, we're a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multinational area. Like, there just needs to be more of us.
So now that we've talked a lot about very important and deep and heavy topics of conversation, we are going to play a game to close this episode with Daniel. And it's a game that we play with all our guests called I Don't Know Her. And so the game goes, me and Ruben are going to name things or people, and Daniel just has to say, I know her or I don't know her. And you can give us a background on why you don't know this person or why you know this person, or you can just simply let it be, right? And of course, this game comes from Mariah Carey's famous interview when she was asked if she knew Jennifer Lopez. And she simply said, I don't know her. So let's jump right in. Ruben, you want to go first?
Yes. Jennifer Lopez, do you know her?
I know her. Yeah. I love her winter looks from the early 2000s.
Yes, they're so iconic. Yes. Sad, one of my friends stole my heavy winter coat.
Yeah, you know, with the fur trims?
Yes. Yes,
I know that. I know her and that.
Okay. Do you know Selena?
I know her, but, like, she's too popular to, like, know me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ruben?
Conchas.
I don't know Conchas.
But that's what I was going to ask.
I feel so dry just saying that.
Okay. How about...
Dip the podcast in coffee now.
I had to mute those, like, everything related to Conchas, because it was so annoying.
I hate it. True Central American ally. I like Conchas. I do. I like eating them, but I feel like every time I get one, I'm like, wow. Like, I think of all the people that are like... Like, I'm such a, like, stereotypical Chicana for saying that, but I really do like conchas. Not, like, I have my room decorated in conchas, but I do like eating that. I'm not going to lie.
You're not going to make concha like vagina breast art?
Oh.
What is wrong with the Chicanx community?
I don't know. You know what I'm talking about though, right?
Yes. I posted that's what I took a picture of that. It was here in El Paso. Yeah, it was here and I was like.
Oh, it tours.
Oh, yeah. She sent me that and then like the conchas were pierced and yeah, they were like dripping. Juicy.
No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
We'll show you after. We'll show everyone. It's awful.
Yeah. Oftentimes we start our day with like ridiculous Chicanx art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like,
we send
and just
to
like
each
laugh
other.
At it. Yeah. Mm. And there was this image of like two breasts that were conchas and they were pierced and they were like juicing for some reason. And we're like, this is the height of Chicanx art, apparently.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Do you know Dichos de un Bicho?
I don't know her. Don't know her.
Gustavo Arellano.
Ugh. Never heard of her. Never heard of her.
That's it.
Okay.
You don't. Yeah. He doesn't know anybody. You don't know anybody.
No.
Well, okay. Well, I do know. I do know. I do know some things about her.
That's how we became friends.
Yes.
Dragging her. But we don't know her.
I know they don't work at Remezcla. Yeah. You know, all I know is tragedy of her.
Yeah. So we don't know her. So thank you for playing the game with us, and thank you for, you know, being on our podcast. I think that, you know, we always talk about, like, you know, centering voices and uplifting voices, but I don't think we've had the opportunity to do that. And so thank you for, you know, working with our schedule too, because I know, like, that mm-hmm. we're also messy recorders. Mm-hmm. We don't know when the fuck anything is happening. And so, yeah, and so we always close the episodes off with like a song, right? And just because we think music brings people joy, right? Mm-hmm. And so we talk a lot about Central American trauma, right? And like all these issues. And so I think it's always nice to also balance that with joy, right? Mm-hmm. And so music is that. Who did you bring for us today?
So thank you for having me. I wanted to close with Rebecca Lane. I don't know how to say her name, and I don't know if it's in Spanish. The song is called Corazón Nomada, and I hope it's a little healing. She's a Guatemalan rapper artist, and the video is very queer, and it's very Central American, so you have to watch the video, and I hope it's a little healing for folks.
All right. So we will leave you with Rebecca Lane. Thank you for joining us once again. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, right? Bitter Brown Femmes. Follow Daniel Alvarenga on Instagram as Salvi Prince, on Twitter as @_DanAlvarenga, and on Facebook at Sava Cultura. And follow all their work on AG Plus. They're doing it big in AG Plus.
And thank you so much again, Daniel, for coming on our episode and for unblocking me on Twitter. You didn't have to. Actually, Daniel didn't unblock me. He just actually made a new Twitter account, and
and then you popped up.
Yeah,
My finger hovered, but then
you're like, I'll give her another shot. Okay. Thank you.
And yeah, so if you want to bring us to your school, email us at bitterbrownfams@gmail.com, right? And any last words, Cassandra?
Nope. I just hope that this episode reaches a lot of Mexican Chicanxes and that we can all just get our shit together, as always, which is the message of all our episodes, apparently.
Yeah. All right, y'all. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Yo tan acá y sin embargo, yo estoy allá y vos acá de vez en cuando. Quiero viajar, acompañarte a los sueños. Mi anzuelo en tus almohadas celestiales. Tantos males en el mundo, hace falta el fuego interno. Nos olvidamos de la diosa y del trueno en el pecho. Y cuando yo te siento adentro, me elevo y el tiempo transcurre lento. Me conecto desde mis ancestros al instinto que me dice que nuestro momento estaba escrito en las estrellas. Viajamos.
estamos juntas a ella. Siento como tocas heridas suavemente. La mente no lamenta que te tomes la molestia de pedir permiso para entrar en mi templo. Te regalo toda el agua que me nace desde el centro. Si el corazón quiere cantar, ¿qué puedo hacer? Ayudar a que fluya en el viento que sale por mi boca y se convierte en movimiento, sonido que vibra y siento. Si el corazón quiere cantar, ¿qué puedo hacer? Ayudar a que fluya en el viento que sale por mi boca y se convierte en movimiento, sonido que vibra y siento. Ahora debo inventar un lenguaje nuevo para poner en palabras todo lo que siento. Y aunque lo intento, las que existen ni siquiera se acercan a este sentimiento. Te quiero cerca, pero no te quiero poner cerco. Quiero la libertad de amar sin sufrimiento, sin etiquetas, inventarnos algo nuevo, no acomodarnos a seguir algún libreto. Por eso te comparto este corazón nómada que más a la distancia no apaga esta llamarada. Espero tu llamada, me gusta cuando hablas de lo que tanto amas. Guerrera, derrumbemos las fronteras, hagamos la primavera. Pon tus dedos en mi tierra, que no nos gane la guerra, que la sangre que nos nace fertilice flores. Y